This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. I'd like for you to look at our programs that we've passed out for our programs this spring, from spring and February now until June. And they're next to you at your seats. So if you would, this is a green sheet, and it also can be found for on our audio audience by going to www.commonwealthclub.org to look at the environmental programs that we will be having this spring. And we welcome you to those programs. Our program tonight is Our Constitution, Our Climate, and Our Children. Is there a right not to be harmed by climate change? And our speakers tonight are a distinguished group with Phil Gregory, partner, Cochet, Petrie, and MacArthur, LLP, Tia Hatton, youth plaintiff in Constitution and Public Trust case, and Julia Olson, executive director, Our Children's Trust. So please welcome our wonderful panel and greet them for us. And we'll ask Phil to begin.
Well, we just saw, for those of you who haven't heard, an amazing judicial feat today where the Ninth Circuit, as in a 3-0 opinion, kept the temporary restraining order nationwide in place over the travel ban. And that is... It's wonderful news, and it's an excellent example about how our courts, who serve as the third branch of government, check the other two branches, the Congress and the executive, when they overstep their bounds. But courts don't just stop actions. Courts can cause actions. Courts can cause the executive branch to take steps, and that's the basis of our suit. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Julia Olson, executive director of our Children's Trust and co-lead counsel on our case.
Thanks, Phil, and thanks everyone for being here tonight. Thanks to Anne and the Commonwealth Club for organizing the event, and it's great to see such support here for the young people involved in this case. So the lawsuit that you're about to hear about for the next hour or so is really a case for everybody, and it's a case for all the children in your lives who you love. And so I want to start by telling you the story of one child who's a plaintiff in the case. She's 13 years old. Her name is Jaden, and she lives in Rain, Louisiana. And for those of you in the audience, you can see the picture of her on the screen. And on August 15th, at 5 a.m., she stepped out of her bed and stepped into water that was up to her ankles in her home. This was during the storms, you might remember, last August in the South. And in her words, she stepped out of bed and stepped right into climate change. So the waters are flowing in. They're coming up from the floors of her home. They're coming through the roof, pouring in. There also is sewage water that's flowing out of the tub and the sinks and the toilets in her home. So she's at home with her siblings. Her mom was in a neighboring community trying to help neighbors and friends who were struggling with flooding from the day before. It took her 13 hours to go several miles to get home to her children. She was thigh deep in water, and her car was flooded. So Jaden's family survived the flood. 13 people in the region died. And our federal government said that this was a 1,000-year storm event. But the problem is these 1,000-year storm events aren't coming every 1,000 years anymore. They're coming with increased frequency and severity. And the government says that it's directly attributable to climate change. So that's a story of one of the youth and the reason that we founded our Children's Trust in 2010. And we did so to really elevate the voice of young people and to give them a platform to secure their rights to a healthy atmosphere and a stable climate system. And you can see on the screen 21 of the youth plaintiffs who are involved in the Juliana versus United States case that we'll talk about in more depth tonight. So we lift up these voices, we give them a way to bring action against governments to compel the needed reduction of emissions that will stabilize the climate system for them and also for future generations on whose behalf they stand. So we connect them with lawyers like Phil Gregory, who donates all of his time pro bono to the cause. He's been doing that for 6 years, along with other people. And he truly is a hero. He's been in it from the beginning. And there are many lawyers like him around the country and around the world who are doing the same thing on behalf of youth everywhere in the state cases and the other global actions that we support. So the laws that we really turn to in this effort are foundational laws. They're laws that explain why we have government in the first place and what our basic human rights are. And one of those is the public trust doctrine. And this is a law that goes back to ancient Roman times and the Justinian Code. It's the baseline, the bedrock of legal systems around the world. And it's simple. It says that government, as a sovereign, is a trustee, and it holds those vital resources that we all depend upon and share in common, like air and water, in trust for the benefit of present and future generations. And the citizens, all of you out there, and these youth who we represent are the beneficiaries of that trust, as are future generations. And so those resources need to be protected so that they can be there for everyone's benefit and use, and not just for the exploitation by the fossil fuel industry. So another thing that's really core about what our Children's Trust does is we are not willing to compromise the stability of our climate system and the longevity of the resources we need for survival. So we look to scientists and experts from around the globe who are doing the most incredible research to really identify what needs to happen to protect the climate system for our great-great-great-grandchildren. And what they say is a 2 degrees Celsius rise in temperatures from pre-industrial levels, which is what the global community has been focused on, is actually catastrophic. Humans have never lived in that kind of world. And we'll see catastrophic sea level rise. We'll see storms beyond belief. We'll see an immense drought, global chaos and disruption. So what we really need to do, and we can do it, is we need to return to an atmospheric carbon dioxide level of 350 parts per million. And we need to stabilize temperatures at less than a long-term warming of 1 degree Celsius. So all of our actions on behalf of youth are uncompromising, and they're based on this best science. Oh, so I hope you're seeing the right slide there. I have an image of what this reflects. And the other thing, just before I turn it over to Phil to talk a little bit more about this movement and this campaign, this really is strategic litigation that's coordinated, and it is based on a campaign. So we do a lot of media work. We give the youth a platform to speak, and we look to other social justice movements to inform the work that we're doing. And I'll let Phil talk about some of those.
Well, I'm going to use three expressions. One is unprecedented, another, a novel theory, third, this is no ordinary lawsuit. You think these would be coming from press clippings, but in fact they're from the opinions judges have written about our case. But we're really not a new theory. This has been going on for decades. When we first started formulating these cases, we focused on the civil rights cases. And we said it's the youth that were put front and center, not only through high school anti-segregation rallies, but the NAACP put kids on trial, as well as the science, showing the harm that separate but equal was causing to the kids in the South. An excellent book on this, if you haven't read it, is Richard Kluger's book, Simple Justice. It's on the history of Brown versus Board of Education and how they got to the decision. But essentially what the NAACP was doing is putting civil rights on trial by having the youth as well as scientists from around the nation testify about the harms that were occurring. So if you read the Brown decision, it really talks about the science that was put before the courts. Another thing that a book that I want to commend to you that I handed out my last copy, it's called Unlikely Heroes. It's by a guy named Jack Bass. And what it is about the judges in the Fifth Circuit in the South who had to implement these decisions. Judges who courageously took on the entire ingrained segregated world. And we thought, well, if there were judges in the South that can do that, are there judges nowadays who are prepared to take on the fossil fuel industry? The other cases we looked at were the tobacco cases, and we all know that the tobacco industry was very big. Doubt is their product. And that's a book by David Michaels. But the whole theme for the tobacco industry is sowing uncertainty. And based on the documents we have gathered and we've received from independent sources, the same public relations folks, the same lobbying outfits that were dealing with tobacco were in parallel dealing with the oil companies. And so the other cases we've been looking at to track are the cases involving Wall Street. My partner Joe Kachet just wrote a book, People versus Greed, and that's what's really going on out there. We are trying to address problems that Wall Street wants to continue to exist. So how do we do that? How do we go after these groups of people? Well, recently, California had a major line of cases involving its prison system. And the prisoners went after the prison system and said, what we're enduring, the conditions we're enduring, overcrowding, poor medical treatment, those violate the Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment clause. And so they went after the California prison system. And those of you who don't know about this line of cases, it's fascinating because the prison system was found to be so overcrowded that the target the court set for the prison system to achieve that said, okay, you'll be okay if you hit a target, is 135% occupancy. So they had to bring it down. And the court said, we're going to start releasing prisoners until you get to that target. And that's a very important for our case when we talk about later. The court setting a target and requiring the governmental body to reach that target, come up with a plan. And if the governmental body can't come up with the plan, in these prison cases, they said, well, we'll have the plaintiffs, we'll have the prisoners set up a plan to come up with the target. And lo and behold, the prison system came up with that target. And finally, I just want to say, the last thing we focused in on is who is going to be the most harmed by what the government has known historically about what's going on with climate change. And obviously, the people who are going to be most harmed are youth and future generations. And that's how we came to determine that kids might be an excellent group to bring this case. Tia Hatton, why don't you talk about how you became a plaintiff here?
Yeah. So I'm one of the 21 youth bringing the suit against the federal government. It was the spring of my senior year, so in 2015, before August of 2015, when we filed the lawsuit. And I was in Bend, Oregon, my hometown, and we were with a youth of high schoolers trying to bring basically we were trying to get us to go to city council meetings to get a climate action plan to cut carbon emissions. And this was because Eugene had just passed a similar plan, and how they did that was that youth had consistently gone to city council meetings telling them that their rights were being infringed upon and that Eugene needed to be responsible to cut carbon emissions. So a group of us youth in Bend were trying to do that as well. And so it was through that that I got connected with Kelsey Giuliana and Eugene, who had previously been on the Oregon State case, and she contacted me asking if I wanted to be part of meaningful climate change. And by meaningful, she meant going to the root of the issue, which was suing the federal government. I was intrigued, of course. my parents were as well. and it was intriguing to me because I've always been interested in environmental law. I was interested in the theory of it, and I was deeply concerned about the place that I loved. And it was more than just the fact that that past winter I had seen my favorite ski trails being closed down because lack of snow. It was that the places that I loved and the people that I loved were being threatened because water is essential to life. And it begins as these small things, and then it grows and it grows. And once you realize the impacts of climate change, you realize how extensive it is and that it's affecting everyone. So it's kind of a no-brainer to jump on something like that. I can honestly say I didn't realize exactly what it was going to be like, and I'm so excited that it's grown to be this big. I don't think I knew at all that it was going to be this big. and each of us, each of the plaintiffs, we all have a background in environmental activism, and we all have our own injuries. So listed in our complaint against the federal government is our own personal injuries. There's, as you can see, or as Julia talked about, is Jaden's impact is just one. There's 20 plaintiffs, and two of my good friends in Roseburg have farms in Roseburg that are being threatened, and the list really goes on, and we each have our own stories, and Julia gets in court and tells them very eloquently, and she is against the federal government, which is really what our case is alleging, is against the federal government, and she's going to explain why we brought it against the federal government and not just the fossil fuel industries, which is something that's important to distinguish. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Tia. So one theme I think you'll see as we talk tonight is storytelling is really important, and bringing out the human element of how climate change is impacting people. So we'll share a few more of the youth stories as we go along tonight. But I want to talk to you about the claims in the complaint. We filed in August 2015. We filed against the United States, the president, all the major departments and agencies that are responsible for our fossil fuel-based energy system and also responsible for not controlling the pollution that's coming out of that system. And I'll just walk through the claims and try to make it as simple and understandable as possible. So this is a constitutional case. It's under the Fifth Amendment, which protects our rights to life, liberty, and property. And the Fifth Amendment is the substantive due process part of our Constitution. And what it means is that government can't do things that infringe on our rights to life, liberties, and property. And so in this case, the personal security of these young people, their very lives in the future, and for many of them who live in coastal regions, their property is being threatened by the actions of the federal government. And I'll go into that a little bit more. But one part of the claim is about when the government knows that it's putting citizens in danger, it creates a duty on government to then act to either prevent that danger, or if the danger exists, to then do something about it. And they can't act with indifference to the harms that they've created. And so a really important part of our case is looking back at for just how long the United States has known that if we kept burning fossil fuels, we would cause catastrophic climate change. And when we started doing research for this case, I think we were all shocked to find that the knowledge goes back to the 40s and 50s, and perhaps even earlier, to the early part of the 1900s. But there was a moment in 1965 when Lyndon B. Johnson issued a report out of the White House, and there was an entire chapter on atmospheric carbon dioxide and climate change. And they predicted with unbelievable accuracy what was going to happen if we kept digging up and burning fossil fuels. They knew that it would cause ocean acidification, they knew it would cause climate destabilization, and they knew the impacts would be catastrophic. So this is a letter from 1969, White House letter, and you can see on the screen that the letter refers to the potential for apocalyptic change. And in terms of talking about sea level rise, they wrote, "This in turn could raise the level of the sea by 10 feet. Goodbye, New York. Goodbye, Washington, for that matter." This is 1965 knowledge. Then during the Nixon White House in 1970, another report came out that said that in the longer term, the quality of the atmosphere may well determine whether man survives or perishes. So I want everyone who's listening to this to really understand how deep and long-lasting the knowledge has been about the climate dangers posed to our country and to the very survival of future generations. So then the question, and I am showing another chart for those listening in right now that just shows going back to 1955 all the way through the present, the various key moments in time when our government issued reports and made critical findings by the top scientists around the world and by the highest levels of our government, up to the presidency, about the need to act on climate change. And this was repeated every decade, every administration. We need to act on climate change. We need to transition off of fossil fuels. But instead, what we did is we permitted more development, more production, more leasing of our public lands for oil and gas extraction and coal extraction, and we kept a fossil fuel-based energy system in place so that no citizen could do anything about this, because this truly is a government-embedded system that we all depend upon. So just for a little comic relief, there have been a lot of international processes that you all probably know about with climate talks going back 22 years. The United States initiated those climate talks as a way to defer taking action on climate change. So the whole United Nations Framework Convention was orchestrated by the United States to avoid setting limits on climate pollution and to keep talking and talking and talking. And so this cartoon says, "It's settled. We agree to sign a pledge to hold another meeting to consider changing course at a date yet to be determined." And that's what our world leaders have been doing. This is Levi. He's 9. And his island is subject to sea level rise right now. He's already lost the beaches that he's played on in his young life. And his home will be underwater if we don't stop what we're doing. And I bring him up because one part of the case is about the discrimination against young people and their right to equal protection under the law. And so if you think of the Obergefell versus Hodges case, which was the decision saying that everyone has a right to marry, that case was about protecting a group of people who were being discriminated against with respect to the exercise of a fundamental right. Well, these children are being discriminated against with their ability to exercise their fundamental rights and not have their personal security threatened. And I just want to show you two more quick slides. And for those listening, this slide shows that under the President Obama's Clean Power Plan, which was, in his words, the single most important thing the United States government has ever done on climate change, would essentially flatline our emissions, our climate pollution, all the way through 2040. So a slight dip when we lose some coal-fired power plants, but it's basically a flatline in emissions. And this was one of the biggest frauds perpetrated on the American public to lead them to believe that the Clean Power Plan was going to solve climate change. And it was never intended to do so. Conversely, this graph shows how steep our emission cuts really need to be to get back to safe levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. There's a blue dotted line that shows if we had started when EPA said we should have started, how it would have been a much easier transition. But now the steep decline is significant, and it's what we aim to achieve in this case. And so Phil's going to tell you a little bit about the defendants and the defenses they raise.
Well,
this is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Our Constitution, Our Climate, and Our Children. Is there a right not to be harmed by climate change? With Phil Gregory from Couchet, Petrie, and McCarthy, LLP, Tia Hatton, youth plaintiff in constitutional and public trust case, and Julia Olson, executive director of Our Children's Trust. Phil, back to you.
Thanks, Ann. Well, I'm doing the defendant's position, so of course I get to wear the black hat here. And let's start off. We only sued the fossil. We only sued the federal government. So the first step in the case was the key trade associations for the fossil fuel industry, the petroleum bunch, and the National Association of Manufacturers. They moved to intervene in our case. Why did they do that? They said, if this case goes forward and these kids win, our business could be dramatically cut back and very well could be eliminated. So the judge let in these trade associations as defendants. So then we had to face what everybody faces in litigation. It's called a motion to dismiss. They say, oh, your claims are all hooey. And the first thing the hooey argument was is what we call standing. Standing means somebody has to prove that under Article 3 of our Constitution, they have a viable case or controversy. So standing has three elements. The first element is there's been an injury in fact. And the defendants argued, you know, climate change is so bad, it's so widespread, that these grievances are general for everybody. And under the law, you can't sue for a generalized grievance. So these plaintiffs don't have standing because they're merely asserting a generalized grievance, not that they've been individually injured. And next, they said causation. They said that the injury that these plaintiffs suffer, they have to be traceable to the defendant's conduct. And you know what? There's no way this is what the defendants say. There's no way these plaintiffs are going to be able to prove that the federal government caused any climate change. Well, let me just tell you that the court, just quickly do aside, took that on. The court said, you know, what in a decision denying the motion to dismiss, the Judge Aiken said, the defendants, as we allege in our complaint, are responsible for more than 25% of global CO2 emissions. That's the United States alone, more than 25%. And because we were able to show there was a significant share, the court said these plaintiffs can prove causation. The third thing about standing, the third claim the defendants asserted, is that you can't do anything about this. You can't do anything about this. There's so many wonderful regulations out there. Let us keep passing enacting regulations, and that's what you should be doing, because, Judge, you cannot do anything. And the judge took them to task on that, saying that If the plaintiffs can show, if these kids can show that the defendants have control over a quarter of the planet's greenhouse gas emissions, then a reduction in those emissions will by nature slow climate change, reduce the probability of harm, and the plaintiffs would then be able to redress their injuries. So we were able to get around that. But the other argument the defendants raised is what we all call separation of powers-based argument called political question. And a political question is not something that involves politics. What it is, it means is that a branch of government, the judicial branch, should not get involved in matters that are entrusted to the other branches of government. So if it's foreign policy, for example, and the Constitution has entrusted that to the executive, you courts should stay out of it. Well, again, remember, this is called the political question doctrine. And de Tocqueville, in his Democracy in America, observed there is hardly any political question in the United States that sooner or later does not turn into a judicial question. And we just saw that, as we said earlier, with the immigration ban. But here, the court said it doesn't matter that the court has to choose which agencies or sectors should reduce emissions by how much. The court is not going to direct any particular action. The judge here is going to, as we request, and Julie will talk more about this in a moment, set a target, as we talked about in the prison cases, and have the defendants come up with a plan to hit that target. And so, as the court said, that's how we're going to do this. The court is going to issue an order, but the executive branch is going to implement that order. Because what we're alleging is that the federal government's aggregate actions, systemic actions, are harming these kids. And I want to point out that in the oral argument, the federal government started off by saying climate change poses a monumental threat. And when the judge turned to the attorney representing the fossil fuel industry and asked him, well, do you agree that there's a threat being posed by human-caused climate change? And that attorney refused to take a position in the court, refused to take a position. Now, we know now that the fossil fuel industry, based on documents we have, clearly was influencing the president. For example, we have the American Petroleum Institute, one of the trade associations that intervene, having in 1998 an action plan: victory will be assured when we sow doubt, when we create doubt in everybody's minds. Well, doubt is their product. That's what their communications plan was in 1998. Another memo we have is a State Department memo, and it's between two officers in the United States State Department stating that they're going to go talk to with a group called the Global Climate Coalition, of which the American Petroleum Institute and the National Association of Manufacturers are members. And they're going to say the president of the United States at this point is George W. Bush rejected the Kyoto Treaty in part based on input from you. So the fossil fuel industry, these intervener defendants, were working hand in glove with the executive to keep the fossil fuel systemic problem in place. And that's been one of the major issues that's come out in the court proceedings. And Tia, why don't you spend a minute talking about what it's like at these court proceedings?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, just coming off after that, it's definitely something I'm aware of when I'm lined up with the 20 other youth, and we look at the government lawyers sitting side by side with the fossil fuel lawyers. And the first time I was just sitting there looking at them, I was wondering, like, do you have children? And I was shocked, because up until this point in my life, I thought the government had been doing kind of a fine job. But I really realized, seeing that visually they were sitting side by side, and I was hearing them in the court of law saying that we don't have rights to a livable future, it was really discouraging. So oral argument is full of, the days of hearing are full of discouragement and encouragement. You kind of go in with like a nervous energy. We're really excited for Julia and Phil, and they're sitting on the left side, luckily, and they're champion. Yeah. I did not mean it like that, but yeah, Julia just does, she's like a champion storyteller, and so it's like there's a lot of legal statutes and all the previous cases that they go off, and you know, some of the stuff goes over my heads, and I'm one of the older plaintiffs, so there's a lot of legal stuff going on, but then there's also the storytelling. There's the moral side of climate change. It's affecting humans, and I think Julia does a really eloquent job bringing that in, and it brings tears to people's eyes. And so that's inside our courtroom. And there's also like two other overflow rooms full of people too, and it's being streamed in Portland, which is really awesome. And then once we leave the courtroom, that's when it's really cool. So when we get out there, there's hundreds of people, hundreds of supporters of all ages, a lot of kids who have come from in town but also out of town, and are just rallying and shouting encouragement. And, you know, they know that this trial is for them too. And it's really encouraging, because I know that everyone in that crowd has their own story too. And it's also really encouraging to see the media there to show that there's people here supporting, and to show that the judge, that people are mobilizing behind this important issue, and that they know that we have a right to this. And that's just going to continually becoming more and more important as we go to trial. So that's something to keep in mind as well. But coming out of the hearings, I don't know if Julia was going to mention this, but the hearings have been putting beyond the fact that I think that Julia has these amazing arguments and that we have a really great case, but the judges make it seem like they are in favor with our case, which I didn't even know was like allowed when I like heard Judge Ann Aiken in the last hearing, when she was just kind of like ripping the government for not settling with us, because they knew that Obama was trying to come up with a plan, and that they admitted they just came to the, they just came up, and the first thing they said was admitting that climate change was human caused. And so basically the judge just said, so why aren't you sitting down with these kids and coming up with a plan? Like, if you can't get stuff through other branches of the government, then why aren't you sitting down with these kids and going through the courts and doing it? So yeah, I was shocked and like, kind of like, what? Did you just say that? but we were all like kind of looking at each other, all the kids and I, and it was exciting. It left us with a lot of hope, and also like kind of, I was kind of confused, because I was like, you know, stuff doesn't usually go your way, you know? But coming out of that hearing and having her decision come out right after Trump was elected it's really a source of hope, and I'm excited for trial and the discovery process for sure. Yeah.
Thanks, Tia.
Yeah.
Thanks for all the kind words. It is really energizing to be at the federal courthouse. It's unlike anything I think Phil or I have ever experienced in our legal careers. We actually had a status conference on Tuesday with the court, with a packed courtroom full of people and people waiting outside to hear about what the next steps were in the case. So it's great to have that level of public engagement and people really seeing this third branch of government in action. So I encourage you all to come check it out sometime in Eugene. So as Tia said, 2 days after we got our new president, and it wasn't the one some of us wanted, we got a great decision from the federal court. And it's a beautiful read, if anyone likes to read legal decisions. We also have some summaries, shorter summaries, on our Children's Trust website, so you can check that out. But I want to read you one of my favorite parts of her decision. She said, there is no doubt that the right to a climate system capable of sustaining human life is fundamental to a free and ordered society. Just as marriage is the foundation of the family, a stable climate system is quite literally the foundation of society, without which there would be neither civilization nor progress. And for those who don't know a lot about our implied liberties that we hold under the Constitution, there's only been probably less than 10 times in the history of our nation where the Supreme Court has recognized an implied right that isn't explicitly written in our Constitution. And some of those implied rights include the right to travel, the right to parent your children, the right to protection from pirates on the high seas, in case any of you were interested, the right to privacy, the right to marriage, the right to self-defense. So the fact that this court has recognized for the first time in our country's history the right to a climate system that sustains life, a habitable planet, an environment that's safe for our children, is really remarkable and critically important as we move forward. The other thing that the court found is that the public trust doctrine applies to our federal government and not just to our states, and that the federal government has an obligation to protect the trust resources that are under its control, like our territorial waters, our ocean waters, and must protect those for the benefit of present and future generations. And that's an affirmative duty on government to protect. And so our oceans are threatened with acidification and sea level rise, and we need to take a little radio break.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Our Constitution, Our Climate, and Our Children. Is there a right not to be harmed by climate change? With Phil Gregory from partner in Couchet Petrie and McCarthy LLP, Tia Hatton, youth plaintiff in constitutional and public trust case, and you've been listening just now to Julia Olson, the executive director of our Children's Trust. We've come to that point in our program tonight for our audience questions, and we will start that just as soon as I give them to Phil. And Phil will be referring back to your audience questions. If you have questions you'd like to ask, please bring them up. That would be wonderful.
Thank you, Ann. So we have some questions here. I'm going to start with this one. Connections with schools could be a powerful way to spread awareness of your mission. Your plaintiffs are an example of empowerment for students. How about schools having ways to bring the Constitution and ideas of civic duty to life? How can schools do that? Julia, Tia, what do you think?
Well, I can talk a little bit about one way we engage with youth at the local level. We have a program called Youth Climate Action Now, and we help support young people in different communities to go to their local governments and try to get laws passed to commit cities to reduce emissions at levels required by science. And to do that, we partner with teachers, we partner with youth organizations, and one of our key partners in this effort is a group called Earth Guardians. They're also a plaintiff organization on this federal lawsuit. And so Earth Guardians has crews all over the country and all over the world. And so any young person who wants to get involved and actually be part of this plaintiff group can start a crew or join a crew from Earth Guardians. And they can also connect to our Children's Trust and get plugged into a local effort.
Another thing we're doing is we're gearing up to try to do something for this Youth Day, April 22, that will try to tie educating children about the Constitution, about climate change, and about our courts. Julia, one other question for you. Why don't you speak briefly about how our children's trust was created and where the idea came from?
Sure. So I was an environmental lawyer for a long time, bringing cases to protect the West. And then I had children and really came to realize that climate change was going to be the issue that would define their lives. And I was frustrated with the whack-a-mole approach of trying to beat down all of these bad environmental projects. And I would bring cases that would have literally nine lives. You know, they do an environmental review, we'd stop it, they do another environmental review. And we're seeing that process right now with the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline that Obama stopped and now Trump's bringing back. So these things just keep coming back. And we weren't getting at the systemic problem of climate change. And I heard Professor Mary Wood speak at the University of Oregon, and she was writing about applying the public trust doctrine to the atmosphere. She calls it atmospheric trust litigation. And she had been looking for crazy lawyers to actually bring these cases that she had been talking about for a few years. And I happened to be one of those crazy lawyers. So we met and just started generating more ideas, and I decided that I wanted to take on this effort of bringing campaign strategic litigation that was coordinated across the country and eventually the world and support lawyers to do these cases on behalf of young people. And so that was the origin. And again, it's really dependent upon people like Phil and young people like Tia who come forward to help lead this effort.
Tia's got a question. Go ahead.
All right, so it says, do you have a message for San Francisco's children and their parents that you would like for this audience to carry forward? I know my input on this question would be to inform young children and youth about climate change and inform other adults if they're not aware of it, and inform them of the court's powers and what's going on about this case. And definitely in these coming months and once the trial happens, organizing people to, you know, hold rallies, hold vigils throughout the trial, which may be weeks on end. And I think starting individual movements is really powerful and definitely, you know, climate change is such like an environmental justice issue, and I think that's why fighting all these different civil rights movements and joining all these different other, you know, rallies going on is really important, because that's a huge part of our case too, is just that it's a justice. I can't say that word right now. It's an issue that infringes on a lot of different rights. So supporting other people and other movements right now is important to us too, and for all of us to be a part of, and also spreading this message of hope to people that something like this is going on, because there's a lot of darkness with this new administration, and this is really a light for people right now.
Thanks, Tia. Mm-hmm. Another question is, what's going to happen next in the case? And here I get to change hats. Put on the white hat. So today, we substituted in for Barack Obama, President Donald J. Trump, as a defendant in our case. And we're hoping downstream to take his deposition. The status conference Julia alluded to that occurred earlier this week, the court told us that it wanted to focus on the science, and we have incredible scientists. A blue ribbon panel of scientists who are going to talk both about the scope of the problem and how we can remedy the problem. And this is going to be science, not alternative facts. Okay? As we were gearing up for this case, we did a lot of informal discovery. We went to websites and we saw documents. For example, here's a 1983 report from the EPA. Can we delay a greenhouse warming? There's reports to Congress where they pinpoint 2015 as the time frame where if we continue on as business as usual, we're going to hit a tipping point. Well, they weren't too far off. And all these reports strongly urged the executive department to do something about climate change. But unfortunately, they continue on in business as usual. So we were troubled when the new administration started taking websites down. So we have sent out a letter telling them to preserve the information. We're also taking steps to take the deposition of Rex Tillerson, and both in his role as chair and CEO of ExxonMobil, as on the executive committee of the American Petroleum Institute, and now what is he going to do about this significant problem in his role as Secretary of State? The other side wants to depose our children. They want to say, well, we want to take the depositions of people like Tia about are you really being injured by climate change? My view is, of course, give me a break, but they're going to do that. And the government has also indicated that it's considering appealing the decision Julia alluded to that came down from Judge Aiken. Finally, we're hopeful to have a trial of this case in the fall, winter of 2017. And that's going to be 3 to 6 weeks where the court will put the science on and we'll see what kind of defense the federal government and the fossil fuel industry throw against us.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Unfortunately, we have reached that point in our program for one last question. And what we have gathered is a lot of questions, and I really appreciate that from the audience. And I do want to thank you, but we just have time for one last question. So, Phil, we'll get back to you for that famous last question. I want the radio audience to know that Phil is definitely wearing his white cowboy hat.
So this is a question that Julia is going to answer. If we're successful at trial, what kind of consequences will the federal government and the fossil fuel industry face?
So if we're successful, if we win this case, life is going to change in a really good way. We're going to have a national plan that sets forth how we transition really quickly off of a fossil fuel-based energy system, including transportation. We're going to be off fossil fuels probably by 2040, predominantly in the United States, and that effort is going to spread around the world. So that's what will happen. And one thing I want everyone to know who's listening is we're also working with the top technical experts and economists around the world who already are developing plans for how we do this. And it's feasible. The only reason it hasn't been done is because there hasn't been political will to do it. But it is feasible, and we'll all be better off and healthier in our communities as a result. And so that's what happens if we win. And I'll say one last thing, Anne, and that is we need everyone's help to win this case. We have massive resources on the other side with the defendants. And our Children's Trust is a small nonprofit. We rely on donations. We also need the public to mobilize and stand with these kids when we go to trial in the fall of this year. And wherever you live, do what you can. Write letters to the editor, opinion editorials. Get the word out about this case. It's going to be the trial of the century on climate. Thank you.
Thank you, Julia Olson. Tia Hatton, if you could add one last sentence, what would it be most important for you to tell our audience?
I would say that I'm a part of this case so that I can look my children in the eye and tell them that I fought against climate change. And I think that's the stance that we're all taking. How are we going to tell future generations how we dealt with this, and the outcome of this case is going to decide how the future looks for future generations.
And Phil, you've done such a wonderful job for all of us. I know it'll be a couple of sentences, but we'd love to hear your last thoughts on this.
Well, I have a great amount of faith in the independence of our judiciary, and our courts are going to stand up as the firm branch of government against ignorance and improper use of power. And I would strongly encourage everybody out there to believe in our court system. It's going to be severely tested over the next 4 years. And if we trust in our judges and we trust in the ability of the courts to be objective and to do the right thing, I firmly believe, like the judges during the civil rights cases, that they will take the steps that need to be taken, and that our future for generations to come will be much better off because of this case.
And Julia, I'll come back to you. What do you want most for the audience to carry back with them that would help your campaign? And I'll ask Phil and Tia also.
I think what I want everyone to carry is everything that Phil just said and that Tia just said is really critical. And it's not just to have hope and belief in what we're doing, but it's to support us in whatever active way you can, whatever that means to you in your life. But it's time to get active, because we're at the end of the line with climate. Time is the enemy, and the status quo is the enemy, and we need to muster all of our energy and courage to really preserve what we've all benefited from in our lives for the next generation.
And Phil?
A week ago, my first grandchild, Alice, was born. I, like Tia, want to be able to look her in the eye and say, I did everything I possibly could. We're at a critical juncture right now. And I want all of you to take away that you can do things. There are opportunities for volunteer work out there. Please take advantage of them. This is a serious moment in the history of our country, and you can step up or you can step aside.
And Tia, for your generation, what would you like to have the audience take away? And
I would like to see more young ladies like these two women that came. They traveled far, and I know they fundraised just to get here to see us, and I think that is so inspiring for me, and I hope that there's more young people like you and like our youth plaintiffs out there mobilizing, because it's really inspiring for me. I know it's our own lawyers are inspired by it, and it's essential to this movement and to where we're moving as going forward in our lives and with this administration. I'm just really excited, and it gives me hope. So thank you for coming.
And would the two young ladies stand up and tell us what grade they're in? And what grade are you in?
Here's $100 to start.
Thank you.
Wow. Thank you. Look. So what grade are you in? Seventh grade? Wonderful. And you? Sixth grade. Well, great. Thank you for being here. This is going to be hard to close our program tonight. We still have a lot of questions that people would like to respond to, and I wish we had the time. So stay tuned. I'm sure we'll all be talking about this both with our friends and our neighbors and people that we need to talk to. And thank you again for this wonderful audience. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Our Constitution, Our Climate, and Our Children. Is there a right not to be harmed by climate change? Our wonderful panel was Phil Gregory, partner of Chuchet, Petrie, and McCarthy, LLP. Tia Hatton, youth plaintiff in constitutional and public trust case. Julia Olson, executive director, Our Children's Trust. And so I'd like for the audience to give a big hand to our terrific panel. And for our radio audience, I want you to know that Phil is waving his white cowboy hat as as we clapped. I also want to thank our wonderful audience here. What a great audience we've had, and we really appreciate your questions and your responses. We want to thank the two young women who came to be with us, and we didn't even know that they were coming to visit us, and we really appreciate your coming and being part of the program tonight. Thank you so much. So let's give a wonderful applause to our audience here and on the radio and the internet who are listening to us. So a great big prize for you, our audience. And for those, who are on the internet. So find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on our website, watch and listen for Commonwealth Club videos, radio schedules, and subscribe to our weekly free podcast and program archives. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you all for being with us tonight. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you.